let's begin. People in the back of the room, if the fans are good, leave them on. If they're distracting or too loud, change them or turn them off. Okay. Couple of quick announcements. First, did anybody at the end of last class find a water bottle here? What color was it, John? Is it blue?
It was a blue water
bottle. So did anybody find a blue water bottle here at the end of last class?
I put a water bottle up there.
Yeah, I saw that.
Around here.
Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe it's
in
Boston.
I'll check again.
Check again. Sometimes it gets like I would check again. All right, everybody, are we settled? Are we settled now?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Secondly, at the end of last class, most of you took the Maslow article that was over there. But one person took the Maslow article that was over here. And that's my copy that was annotated for my lectures that I give at City College. So if you have the copy that says annotated in the top right, okay, then give it back to me and I will give you a copy that doesn't have annotated in the top right, because I need that copy. So please do check that. Okay. And again, there are more copies for people who weren't here last week of both the Maslow and the Rogers articles over there. So please do, let's find that for me, so I don't have to do that work again. Next thing, Don.
Spencer mentioned last week that we collect a little bit of money, if you can contribute a couple of dollars, so that we're able to bring in great speakers. I want to make it really easy. I'm not going to make a check. So I found out how the check is addressed. If you could look back, if you want to drop a couple of dollars in, that's fine. Write a check for $5. I'll make sure that it gets to the person.
Yeah. And cash is good as well.
Okay. I'm
okay
for
like
next Friday.
If
you can come
for
our Friday, like next Friday.
Sure. Yeah, give it to
Don
the
next Friday.
No,
okay.
Will the basket be here next Friday?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So this is I'm Allison.
What do you make the check payable to?
It says.
Show there's a sample on the basket.
Okay. So. This is something that Donna proposed. I think it's a great idea, but there's no onus. You don't have to do this. It's just, it'll be whatever we collect goes into the trust fund for this class so that I can draw from it for the gift certificates, for the guests we have, or for materials like for the Xeroxing. But we're not starving. Okay, so don't worry about it. But if you wanted to drop in a couple of bucks, that would be helpful. It would pay for the Xerox in this term anyway.
So mine Supermine is canceled?
Mine Supermine is canceled this fall, and we have two of them in the term thereafter.
Okay, it's canceled.
I'm not going to go into it now, not a time. I'll go into it maybe in a week when I have a little more time, okay? For right now, it just is. I can't devote the time to it, okay? Art fair, okay. This is important. Bring your art next week, please, okay? And put it around the room. And probably get here a little early to set it up. And then there'll be time to look at it. It would just be nice, and we're also going to be talking about the fifth chakra, so it would be nice to have a lot of artwork around at any time, okay? And I'll do what I can to, maybe the class might be a little shorter such that we have a little more time at the end of class to go looking at various things or listening to various things. So do remember, that's next week, okay? Right. Kind of wait till everything is settled. is the fourth chakra. And so I thought that in our mindfulness, you might focus particularly on feelings, on whatever feelings that you're having. For some people, this is very easy to do because the feelings are very obvious and constant. But for many of us, especially when you're beginning in mindfulness, the feelings are not evident. They've been ignored or suppressed for long enough so that all that's evident is thought. So there's a lot happening up here, but there's not a lot of content beyond that. So where do you look, children, for your feeling? I ask this to all my students, and all right, how many of you know how you're feeling right now? You take 10 seconds and find out how you're feeling right now. Wait, just take 10 seconds. Okay, how many people know how they're feeling right now? Okay, if you went to your head to figure out how you are feeling right now and you stayed there, would you leave your hand down? Now, how many people know how they're feeling right now? Still a good number because you're you. But typically in a random group, three quarters of them raise their hand at least at the beginning. And after I say about the head, how many people know, then two or three raise their hands. Because most of us think about our feelings or go to our head to find our feelings. So children, and this is the way I address them, and I'm addressing you, where do you go to find your feelings? If you were a kindergartner, where would you point where your feelings are?
Maybe your stomach.
Yeah. We're the whole thing. So the point is, when we do the mindfulness this time, and I give you 7 minutes to simply be aware of whatever is happening, then you might spend some time just asking yourself, what am I feeling? And opening yourself up to the experience that's whole being experience, rather than the commentary in your head. Secondly, in Buddhism there are two basic kinds of meditation. Open awareness meditation, where you're just aware of whatever's happening without being caught up in it. The other kind of meditation is called metta, M-E-T-T-A. Many of you know this. It's a meditation that has to do with opening your heart and either flowing love out to yourself, people that you love, people that you know, people that you have issues with, the whole world, or bringing those people into your heart. So it's a heart-opening meditation. And so because this is the fourth chakra that we're dealing with, you might want to spend some of the time in your meditation doing metta, or praying for people, or sending love to people, or feeling love for people in your heart. Okay? I'm not going to direct that, but I'm going to suggest that. So what I'm going to do right now is, using the microphone, so I don't lose my voice, lead you briefly, because we've been week by week building a structure, lead you through paying attention to your breathing, and then progressively softening and opening your body. And then I won't talk at all for 7 minutes. And in that 7 minutes, you can either get lost in thought, go to sleep, or you can keep returning attention to your breathing, softening and opening around your breathing so that you become a field of awareness with no boundaries in which thoughts happen, feelings especially happen, sensations happen, and your breathing happens. So, let's have the doors closed, at least for this. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see how that works. Is this pretty good? Pretty good at the level for people?
Too loud?
How's that? Is that better? Right about like this? Still too loud? How about this? Is this good? Yeah? Yes? Perfect? Okay. One request is, because there are so many of us, and because time is so precious for the class, please, if possible, get here 5:10:15, so that we don't have 10 minutes of non-focus first. I know sometimes it's not possible, but whatever it is, please do. This is the world's cheapest vacation. This is a vacation from your usual life, from your usual sense of self, and from your usual conundrum. That is, in this time when we sit, you are only present. There is no past and no future. Whatever has happened is not relevant. Whatever will happen is not relevant. You are simply letting go, opening up into the present moment and whatever your life experience is. So, sit upright, but not rigidly, like a mountain, with dignity. Close your eyes. Put both feet on the floor, if possible, so that you are stable and symmetric. And feel that you're breathing. If you need to take off your shoes or loosen them so that they don't distract you, or if you need to loosen any article of clothing so you can breathe easily, do that. As your body discovers tension, it will automatically shift its position to release that tension. So you allow that to happen. You allow the slight shifts of posture to take place. So just feel your breathing. What parts of your body are moving as you breathe? You'll undoubtedly notice that the front of your body moves. The belly rises and falls, and you let it do that. You let your belly be soft, so that it can move easily and naturally. Your chest moves also up and down, in and out, but a little less pronouncedly than does your belly. If you pay close attention, you realize that your whole upper body is participating. That is, with each in-breath, everything opens and rises slightly, including your back opening and rising slightly, your head and neck and shoulders and arms opening slightly, and rising in the case of the head and neck. So everything opens. The in-breath rises with the in-breath, and then closes, falls with the out-breath, just very slightly. You can even imagine, or perhaps sense, that your legs and feet even turn out with the in-breath and turn in slightly with the out-breath. You don't change your breathing, you just notice it. You just let it adjust itself.
Anything else that you notice, you just accept. You just notice that it exists and return your attention primarily to your breathing. Pay special attention to your face. Let your face soften. If you're holding any tension, as we typically do in the muscles of your face, let that tension dissolve away. Your face is softened. The area around your eyes is softened. You can perhaps feel the muscles of your eyes letting go a little bit. Because we overuse those muscles quite typically. So your eyes are not held closed, they're just gently, softly closed. Check your mouth and jaw. If there's any tension held in those areas, let it release itself and melt away. So your mouth and your jaw are soft. If your mouth is closed, it's softly closed. It may even be slightly open. Your face is just softening and relaxing. Similarly, the sides of your head, back of your head, top of your head, releasing tension, softening and opening. It's almost as though your face and head are disappearing. Where there used to be a solid face and head, now there is open space, spaciousness. You just let that process happen. It happens by itself. You can feel your breathing just happening as it is. The rising and falling of the front of your body, the involvement of your whole body in your gentle breathing. Pay special attention to your neck, shoulders, arms, and hands. If there's any tension held in those areas, let it release itself and dissolve away. To your neck and shoulders, arms, and hands are softening and opening. It's almost as though they're disappearing. And where your neck and shoulders and arms and hands used to be, now there's spaciousness, openness. You can feel your gentle breathing just happening naturally, easily. Pay special attention now to your torso, back, sides of your body, front of your body, and your internal organs. Let everything soften and open. So any tension that's held in your back, sides of your body, front of your body, or inside your body, any tension dissolves away. It's almost as though your torso begins to disappear. And where there was a solid torso, now there's openness, spaciousness.
Anything else you notice is fine. You just notice whatever is happening. You don't try to do anything about anything. Just let it all be as it is. Pay attention especially to your breathing. The movement of your belly especially as you breathe. Now pay attention to your lower body, lower back, pelvis, legs, and feet. If your body needs to make any micro movements to let go of tension, let it do so. So that your lower back and pelvis, legs, and feet soften and open. There's any tension in those areas, it releases itself. It's almost as though your lower body is disappearing. It's becoming so soft and open. It's almost like it's not even there. And there's just empty space where your lower body used to be. At this point, there's your breathing and a wide open awareness. A consciousness without edge or limit. Open in all directions and all dimensions. Whatever occurs is simply noticed. I'm not going to speak now for 7 minutes. After 7 minutes, I'll ring the bell. But in this 7 minutes, my suggestion is that you be especially aware of your feelings. But any time you lose touch with your breathing, bring awareness back to your breathing, open your awareness around your breathing, and notice whatever else is occurring.
wish we could take that energy and transport it wherever it needs to be. But it sure is a nice group of people to sit with. I think we need the doors open again. Thanks. Okay, so, every time that you came back to your breathing from being lost somewhere, that's a moment of mindfulness. So even if you were lost the whole time and once you thought, oh my God, where's my breathing? You came back to it. That's an extraordinary, that's a real accomplishment. And if you do that about a trillion times, you may find that you spend more of your time present and less of your time in an idea that you are present. All right, so, fourth chakra. First chakra, root. Second chakra, shoot. Third chakra, stem, trunk. Fourth chakra, reaching out with bows, with arms, to the world. And this is when you come out of self-focus more and interact in a more full-being way with the world. So this, again, using the flowering tree metaphor, this is the bows, the arms. And it supports the higher structure. At a first level, this has to do with connection. Fourth chakra has to do with connection. Being in touch with other people in the world. At a deeper level, it has to do with fusion, with union with other people in the world. So sometimes they speak of a surface heart and a deep heart. We are, an apology as usual. This is a huge area. I'm not going to cover everything that I can cover about the area of connection, but I'm going to cover a few things selectively. Okay. So, first of all, it turns out we're wired for connection. Something about our brain and nervous system is already in place for connection. Some of you have heard of mirror neurons. This is very controversial, by the way. All this work with mirror neurons is very new. But the idea is that they, in primates and in humans, in several places in the brain, and maybe in some birds, in several places in the brain, there are these mirror neurons that are responsible for imitation and empathy. So when you know how when somebody smiles, it's kind of hard not to smile? Supposedly that's mirror neurons at work. The mirror neuron fires when it perceives somebody else's feeling and it induces that same feeling in you. It also does the same thing for emotions. When you see somebody make a motion, already in your brain you're making the motion. So mirror neurons, many people now believe, are the basis for our human beings' ability to empathize with one another and to understand one another. Two experiments that show this, whether they involve mirror neurons or not, that show this rather remarkably. The first one is by Andrew Meltzoff and Keith Moore. Starting in the 1970s, what they did is they made faces at newborns. Quite young children. And they found out pretty reliably that young children imitated whatever expression they put on their face. So they would stick out their tongue at the newborn, the newborn would stick out his tongue. Or they would open their mouth, the newborn opened his mouth. Purse the lips, the newborn purse the lips. And they did a lot of research on this, and it's pretty well established that newborns imitate faces, facial expressions. Secondly, in an even more startling experiment than in the 1990s, they took a bunch of folks whose names I kind of can't pronounce, Johnson and et al., took a disc and they put a stick. They put this on it. So this is just a disc with this. Okay. something like that. And they passed it in front of the visual field of 1 hour old children. And the children tracked the face with their eyes, and then they rearranged the same things on the disc in a different way. They put the eye here and the mouth here, you know, and the children didn't track. Were wired to track the face, or much, they were much less likely to track the disc with the same elements that wasn't arranged like a face at 1 hour. So this seems to indicate that there's something in us that is wired for connection. I think that there's more to it than mirror neurons, because there's something called equine therapy that many of us know about. There was actually somebody that years ago gave a Mind Supermind talk on this. The idea is horses seem to be amazingly empathic, and that can be used for therapeutic effect. And those of you who have pets, especially dogs, I don't know so much about cats, but dogs seem to kind of know. And lately there's been some research about why they know, and one reason might be, for whatever other reasons, one reason might be dogs have learned to look at the left side of your face selectively. Did you know that? Why? I found this on a Nova video. Why? Because it turns out that when we make emotional expressions on our face, which is the way that Darwin said that we learn to read other people's feelings, it's the expression of emotion in man and animals, you know, that we all have the same expressions, and that tells another animal, I'm angry, don't fool around with me, or, you know, I'm sad, come comfort me. The point is that, the point is that in making these facial expressions, we tend to make them more with the left side of our face than the right side of our face. They appear earlier and more pronouncedly on the left than the right side of the face. And dogs, being really smart, have learned to read our emotion by reading the left side of our face selectively. You don't believe this, go home and make expressions. And you'll see that the right side of your face doesn't work as well as the left side of your face in making these expressions. Typically, okay? So the point is, even in animals that may not have mirror neurons, they're wired for connection. There's a basic evolutionary reason why we connect. Bart, those of you who remember last year, I showed you a video about Love 2.0, Barbara Fredrickson talking about her view of love. And she said love is not what we think it is. It's any shared moment of biobehavioral synchrony. Any shared moment of biobehavioral synchrony, which means anytime two people are doing the same thing in the presence of one another, that's a moment of fusion. That's a moment of love. We'll have more to say about that in the winter, I'm sure. So there are two varieties of connection. You can connect with activities outside yourself, or you can connect with people, and or you can connect with people. So activity, in connecting with activities outside yourself, if you lose yourself in that connection, that is called flow, right? And it turns out that positive psychology says that the people that are the happiest are the people who have the most flow in their life, the most ability to lose themselves in what they're doing, in things that they choose to do. You can lose yourself in your taxes. But you don't come out thinking, oh God, that was a great appeal. But the things that you choose, if you can get lost in those things, you can go beyond yourself, forget about yourself, then when you come back to yourself, you're enriched by that. Connection with people. Typically, when we interact with somebody else, when we talk with somebody else, we're still thinking, we're still in ourselves. We're thinking our own thoughts. We're making our rebuttal. We're thinking of other things. So we're giving half attention. And that's the norm, and everybody's accustomed to that. But if you listen mindfully, you let go of yourself, and you simply share life with that other person at that moment, you take their point of view. They're the one that is creating the reality. And when you do that, it makes a different kind of connection. It makes a much more extraordinary connection.
Excuse me? That's you versus the class. We give ourselves over to you and take your thinking and your, and we allow ourselves to just be what you think it is.
If you do that, that's great, if I lead you well, but I think many people have no experience in that. They're thinking, no, that's not right, or what am I going to do at 12 o'clock? Or, you know, there's all these layers between yourself and somebody else, typically, but some folks are better at letting those layers go.
Your guided meditation.
Yeah, during that meditation, most of us are able to do that, but then we're talking to one another, not so much. Because your eyes are open and you have to do a self-presentation. All right, emotional intelligence. Huge topic, but I told you this before, my cast on emotional intelligence, my definition of emotional intelligence is four things. Knowing how you're feeling moment to moment. Being able to deal with your feelings moment to moment in an optimal way. Knowing how other people are feeling moment to moment, and knowing how to deal with their feelings moment to moment. So that's a good way to ask yourself, to what extent am I emotionally intelligent? To what extent is my emotional process conscious? Do I know what it is at each point? Can I use it well at each point? When I deal with other people, do I feel how they feel? And do I know how to deal with their feelings? One more thing about emotional intelligence. The conflicts that people have, groups have, and nations have typically involve wanting to get your needs met and feeling like the other person is not allowing that, or the other entity is not allowing that. But in fact, each entity in any connection or dispute has needs, and it's valid to have needs. So the way to go beyond impasses is to ask the other person or entity, what are your needs? What are you expressing? What do you know? What do you want? And here's what I need. Here's what I want. It's valid for you to want what you want. It's valid for me to want what I want. Can we together create a situation where we both get our needs met? Instead of, I'm right, you're wrong. So this needs-based approach to relationship, connection, negotiation, I think is necessary and effective. It honors the other person's point of view. It says, wherever you're coming from, it's valid to be coming from that point of view. It's based on a fundamental need that you have. But how do we get my need met and your need met? How do we get both needs met? That's the only acceptable solution, is one that satisfies the basic needs of all the parties. That's a whole other huge topic, but okay. So I have raced through that because I want to take a little more time with the basic lesson for this morning. And then we'll see two paradigms of fourth chakra opening. Or open fourth chakra. Okay, what I want to talk to you about is attachment. Many of you know something or quite a bit about this, so I will be succinct.
What does attachment mean?
Attachment?
Oh, I don't know.
I'm hearing you. Attachment. I have talked about this before. So let me talk a little bit about attachment. Let me see if I have anything to tell you before that. Nope. Okay. Where did this stuff come from? Now, this is very important in psychology now, as you know. Where did this come from? It originated with a British psychoanalyst with ethological leanings named John Bowlby.
Oh.
I guess I should write some of these names down, right?
Being you who you are, you'll go search all this stuff, so. attachment. So Bowlby, in 1950, was asked by the World Health Organization to report on the health of children who had been orphaned by World War II. Oh, I should say, what do I mean by ethological means? Bowlby was a psychoanalyst, but he knew about the work of Conrad Lorenz. Lorenz was the guy who found out that goslings and a lot of other animals have critical periods early in their life when they imprint to whatever they see. So Lorenz would walk around his farm with goslings following after him because they thought he was mom, because he was the first thing that they saw when they first were hatched. Okay. So Bowlby realized that there might be something in humans that had to do with critical periods of development early in development and with imprinting to certain people or things in those critical periods. So Bowlby is asked in 1950 to report on the health of the orphans from World War II. And he looks at various places, but primarily he looks at British orphanages, because he's a Brit. And he expects to find very healthy kids, because British orphanages, after all, are British. And so they're very well run. There's very good food and very nice quarters and very good staff. And what he finds is his first report he published in 1951, and then he published reports for 30 more years, three volumes actually about this. But what he found in 1951 is his kids were doing badly, not well at all. They were getting really good custodial care, and the older ones were getting in trouble with the law, typically for thievery. The younger ones were, there was depression throughout the age ranges. The younger ones were doing things like headbanging. And some of the youngest ones even died for no apparent reason. So why did this happen? After all, they were getting fed, they were getting housed, they were getting cared for. Bowlby said it seems to be necessary for proper development to have a, quote, warm and continuous relationship with at least one adult caregiver. A warm and continuous relationship with at least one adult caregiver. In other words, you got a bond. And these kids, their staff kept changing, you know, every 8 hours somebody new would come and then staff would get rotated. And so these kids, a lot of them didn't have an opportunity to bond to one person. And that seemed to be critical for their development. So, this changed the way that institutions were run around the world after a lot of picking and screening. Starting in the 1960s, by the way, we're getting to you. This ain't about kids. A dialogue. Mary Ainsworth at Johns Hopkins University said, let's take this into the laboratory and see if we can understand it better. So she invited into her lab, which was set up like a playroom, with a one-way mirror in the back. Psychologists just love those one-way mirrors. So that she could see what was happening. So there's this playroom, and she invites mothers and one-year-old children to come into the playroom. Okay. And in the playroom, there are a couple of seats, and then some distance away, there are all these really good toys. And so the basic prototype, it's called the strange situation test, and the basic prototype of this is mom and kid come into the laboratory, sit down, a stranger comes in, sits down next to mom, talks to mom. We see what the kid does. We see if the kid goes to play with the toys. Then mom leaves, see what the kid does. Stranger tries to play with the kid, see what the kid does. Mom comes back, see what the kid does. Now, there are various paradigms here. Sometimes mom would leave several times, the stranger would leave several times, but what it just told you is the basic paradigm. Mom leaves, mom comes back, a stranger tries to play, mom comes back, see what the kid does. So Mary Ainsworth said kids fall into three categories. And I'll write the categories down, okay? Secure, avoidant,
Now, these numbers are a little different, which is why I'm not going to put them on the board, because you see, depending on who did the research and how recently it was done, they're a little varying. But about 60% of kids, she said, are what she called securely attached. That is, when they come into the laboratory, they stay with mom, and then they see the toys, and eventually, not too long, they go to play with the toys, looking back at mom. Look at mom. So they maintain contact with mom, but they do go play with the toys. Then mom leaves, and they're upset. They cry. The stranger comes and tries to play with them, and they can be comforted. Not entirely, maybe, but they can be comforted and play with the stranger. And when mom comes back, they go rush up to mom, they hug her, happy to see her, and then they go back to playing with the toys. So they use mom as a secure base. That's about 60% of these kids. The other, about half of the rest of the kids, of the other 40%, are what they call avoidant, or what she called avoidant. That is, they come into the laboratory, they immediately go to play with the toys, they don't look back at mom. When mom leaves, they aren't distressed. When the stranger tries to play with them, they play with the stranger just as well as if it were mom. When mom comes back, sometimes they don't even go up to mom, or if they go up to mom, it's briefly, and they go right back to playing with the toys and ignore mom. These are what Ainsworth called avoidant. They don't seem to have a bond. Third group, ambivalent. These are kids that when they come into the laboratory, they cling to mom. And it's only quite a bit later that they go to play with the toys. And when mom leaves, they're incredibly distressed. And the stranger cannot comfort them. And when mom comes back, they typically rush up to mom and hold her for dear life. And then they have a curious thing. They also kind of turn away at the same time, like they're angry. So she called them ambivalent, because they have these conflicting feelings. Now, later research has made us realize that kids don't fall so discreetly into these three categories. So this is a shorthand. There's kind of mixtures of these things. And in fact, Mary Main, in the 1970s, said, we ought to put a bunch of these kids that we call avoidant or ambivalent into a third category called disorganized, disoriented, because they're kind of halfway between. And since I can do anything I want, I'm going to tell you that there are really not three categories, there are only two. They're secure and insecure. And avoidant kids, or avoidant people, they have a huge need for love, but it's never been satisfied. So they have become self-contained units, and they have to take care of themselves. But if you look at an avoidant adult, which we're getting to, underneath their "I don't need anybody," there's a black hole that can never be filled, they feel. And so they adopt an avoidant stance because it's too threatening to deal with how much loss there is and how much pain there is. So I think it's only secure and insecure. We're not quite there yet, okay? We're almost there. Yeah, we are there. So in the 1980s, Sidney Hazen and Philip Shaver realized that this pattern, actually Bowlby said this in the 1950s, but Hazen and Shaver said it better, or elucidated it better. It turns out that this pattern, I gotta go back a little bit, okay, which is, why would these kids be in these three categories? Why would a kid be anything but securely attached? A securely attached kid, that's kind of normal development, right? The child bonds with mother, uses her as a secure base for exploration of the world, has confidence that she's always there. That's secure attachment. So what about this other 40%? What kind of parenting do you think would cause an avoidant child? I'll answer it because it's a rhetorical question, because we haven't got time. That would be the kind of parenting where the child didn't get warmth. The mother was either... Now, this work was all done with mothers and children. The question is, what about fathers? And certainly they're important. But this work, this prototypical work was done with moms and kids. So this is a mom who is not there for the kid in some sense. Either so narcissistic that doesn't actually see the kid's just an appendage, or going out with guys and not at home, or the kid is being raised by employees, or the mother just doesn't have the capacity to be warm for some reason. So these are kids that didn't get the love they needed, and they realized at a very early age they weren't going to get that love, and that they were going to have to take care of themselves. And these are kids that become self-contained because they have, in order to survive, they have to take care of themselves. What about ambivalent kids? Ambivalent kids get love, but not consistently. Sometimes mom's drunk, sometimes she's out, sometimes she's preoccupied, whatever. So these are kids that get the taste of what real love is, so they know how important it is, but it gets taken away a lot. And so when they get it, they hold it for dear life, and they're mortified that when it, you know, that it gets taken away. And they're angry about the fact that it gets taken away. So now we got to go to Cindy Hayes and Philip Shaver. So in the 1980s, they realized that this pattern is a prototype for the rest of your life. This is an imprinted pattern in a critical period that now determines how we interact with other people. People that we're close to, we're friendly with, we're intimate with, how do we interact with these people based on what we have learned very, very early in life? And it turns out that adults fall into three categories. About 55% of adults are securely attached. About 45% of adults are either avoidant or ambivalent or a mixture thereof. So what would it be like if we could bring two securely attached adults to sit on a couch in front of the room? They would sit down next to one another, maybe touching, maybe with a little space. Each of them would have their own identity, and they would be a we as well as two me's. It would be an appropriate distance between them, an appropriate amount of independence and connection. What about if we brought a couple in here, one of whom was avoidant? They would sit down on the couch, and then the avoidant one would scoot away a little bit. I need my space. You know, don't feel comfortable when you're that close. What about if we brought, that's an avoidant person. What about if we brought two people in, one of whom was ambivalent? They would sit down, and then the one would say, "Can I sit on your lap?" That's the person that needs fusion with the other person, because they're afraid that any distance will create a rift, you know, that will go away. What about if we brought an avoidant and an ambivalent, which too often is the case? The avoidant one would be going like this, the ambivalent one would be going like this. We'd have to get rid of it and go on couch. It's funny, but half of adults are patterned this way. So what do you do about this if you realize that, you know, I'm not really great with relationship, and, you know, what am I supposed to do here? I mean, divorce isn't, you know, there's a lot of divorce. Some of that probably has to do with this. So there are three. Chris, really.
Just quickly. I heard a guy speak yesterday who was very close to Gorbachev, and his wife, Raisan, had studied some of this from the West, and she made him aware that the number one problem in Russia was going to be their children from their orphanages who were never connected human. Mother Russia was the principal, that's their mother, and they were major messed up. And he was hugely concerned, and this guy helped him set up a foundation to help the audience and improve things. Anyway,
yeah, this is not unknown, this is known. Okay. So, what I got to tell you now is, because this is about how to open this, what do you do if you realize that you have some avoidant or ambivalent or both tendencies? That is many of us. So, three things. First thing is you have to realize that it is not random
why your marriage blows up, your relationships blow up, you have trouble with your friends. You know, it's not random that this is an unconscious pattern that's being acted out. You have to have self-awareness. You have to go, oh my God, I think there's something, I mean, I think I'm part of this whole thing. It isn't all their fault all the time. But that's not enough. Just that awareness will not change you. This is about relationships, so it has to be repatterned in relationship. So there are two alternatives. One alternative is you find a good therapist who, if you are avoidant, and you call up, and things are getting hot in therapy, that is, you're getting to the real deal, and you call up and say, no, I can't make the session next Thursday, she says, excuse me, our deal is you come on Thursday. If you want to work with me, you get here on Thursday. So if you're pushing like this, she repatterns you over time to be appropriate. She says, no, that's not appropriate. And she shows you how to relate to a secure person in a secure way. She's a model of that, and she adjusts your behavior toward more security. And she can reparent you, or he can reparent you. The other thing is you can find a partner who is secure. And if that partner is crazy and loves you enough, that partner will go through hell for you. Because that partner will repattern you, will help to kind of reparent you this way. So let's say you're ambivalent and you're afraid that your partner is ignoring you, is paying attention to other people, is whatever, and so you're calling your partner every half an hour. Where are you? Why aren't you home? What are you doing? And your partner has to say, I love you, I'm not going to leave you, it's all right, I don't want you to call me every half an hour, I have other things to do, I'll be home at this time. So your partner gradually repatterns you by showing you, demonstrating security, and also by showing you what is appropriate behavior. And over time, one can adjust to some extent anyway, and hopefully to a large extent, and maybe a total extent, adjust one's patterning. Because after all, these are just neural connections that can be repatterned. So that's a little bit about if you have trouble completely trusting other people and opening your heart to other people and feeling a warmth and a bond with other people, it's not your fault because it happened. The patterning, trauma at various points can also close you up. Okay, but the point is most of us were patterned very, very early in our life and we just run that pattern out for the rest of our life. But it's possible with self-knowledge and work to change those patterns so that one has better connection with other people in the world, fuller connection, more satisfying, vital connection. So this attachment work is really important. I need to shift gears now and show you a paradigm of two paradigms of real open-heartedness, okay? In the winter, I'll talk to you more about emotions, what the real nature of emotion is. Because the way most people think about emotion, the way psychology currently thinks about emotion, is not as good as it could be. Okay, so we need to have things closed up. Because we're... Okay. I need one light on. So let's put one light on so I can see. Oh, there it is. I just gotta put one. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do that.
I haven't said anything about, remember I said that it's about the heart and the arms? I haven't said anything about physical touch. I've said about emotional touch. I haven't said anything about physical touch. Turns out that physical touch is really important. Early in life, that is, a lot of research that shows that premature babies who are actually physically touched gain weight a lot better, and they actually put premature babies on things like wool that stimulates their touch receptors. They gain weight a lot quicker than babies on sheets, for example. So touch seems to be really healing at any point in life, and important at any point in life. So instead of me talking about that, I'm going to have somebody that really knows talk about that. So this is a YouTube video I found about a rather remarkable doctor. Both what she's saying is really amazing and her presence is really amazing.
At McCormick, our taco story starts in pursuit of pure. We source pure cumin, whole pepper pods, and whole liver oregano. And there's no end.
Just give me the end.
When was the last time you had human contact? And I'm not talking about sex, necessarily. I'm talking about human touch, such as hug from your grandparents, or a smile from your neighbor, or a kiss from your child. Scientists claim that there are three basic needs in order to survive. We need oxygen, food, and water. And I want to suggest a fourth one, which is touch. And I will tell you a personal story how touch became so important to me. I have 5 children. My first are twin boys. During the delivery, there were certain complications. And Rote, who is my second one, was born without a pulse. He has undergone resuscitation and immediately moved to the neonatal intensive care unit. It all happened very fast. I didn't have time to see him, not to mention hold him. Only after 36 hours, we finally met. I vividly remember entering the department, approaching the incubator, and there he was, so tiny and fragile. I wanted so much to touch him. So the nurse took him gently and put him in my arms. I remember looking at him, and he felt uncomfortable. His eyes were full of fear. His heart rate was fast, his breathing was shallow, and he looked restless. And it took a few moments until he started to relax. His heart rate decreased, and he felt much more calm. And I was trying to think, what just happened in the last moments? And then it occurred to me that the last 36 hours, he endured a battery of tests, examination, pin prick needles. He was handled, but not even one time he had a loving touch. I felt that it was not only my presence, but also my touch that created the change. And only 48 hours later, we got the permission to go home. So I felt it then as a man, and I know today as a physician, touch can heal. So I became a pediatrician, and my specialty is premature babies. I'm the director of the neonatal department in one of the leading hospitals in our country and the biggest in the Middle East. And it's a beautiful profession. I mean, we create life. We bring 1 pound baby to grow into a 100 pound person. It's really amazing. Prematurity is a baby that's born before 37 weeks or before 8 months of pregnancy. And we treat extremely small babies, even less than 1 pound. They are extremely vulnerable. All the vital organs are not developed, especially the lung. And we give oxygen through mechanical ventilation. We give food and water through IV lines. And we succeeded to decrease mortality in the last decade. However, We still have many complications, especially neurodevelopmental ones, and we try to improve our outcome. And I always say that when we try to improve something in the future, we have to go back to our past, to go back to our basics. And what are our basics? Our basics is what I call the three C's. It's contact, connection, and compassion. And I will elaborate. I remember one day walking in the department, I saw a mom sitting in the incubator, and she just had twin girls, 33 weeks, 2 pounds each, and she was sitting very distant from the incubator, and I approached her and I asked her, why aren't you touching your girls? Why don't you have skin-to-skin contact with them? And she said, I don't know, they're so small, and all these pipes and the tubes out of them, and I'm afraid that if I touch them, I'll get connected, and they might not survive. I told her, your touch can help them survive. Just recently, there was a publication from Harvard University claiming that the skin-to-skin care for low birth weight reduced mortality in 36%. That's not a small number. What happened medically when we touch? When we are being touched, there is a release of oxytocin. It's a hormone, we call it the bonding hormone. When oxytocin is released, cortisol level decreases, heart rate decreases, and we feel much more trusted, secure. When being touched, we feel less pain and less stress. For the mom, skin-to-skin care enhances her breast milk production. And when preterm are being touched, it improves their weight gain. And I think it's the only time in our life we are very happy gaining weight. So she listened carefully, and she started to touch her girls and to have skin-to-skin contact with them. And they are 5 years old now and beautiful girls. But contact is not only physical. We need to create connection. We need our second C. And there is a joke about our profession that we are like veterinary medicine. Both of us do not really speak with the patients. And that's true, we don't really communicate with the babies or with the children, but we do have our parents. And the parents are our patients as well. Parents are overwhelmed from the situation they are in. Suddenly they have a baby before time, they didn't plan it. They spend weeks and months in our department and sometimes in life-threatening situation. And they are in extreme anxiety and stress. And we need to treat them and to help them. Because lowering their anxiety helps the outcome of their baby. I remember talking to parents few hours after the delivery of their child, and explain to them about health issues and what to expect in the next few days, and they listened quietly and nodded with their head. 2 days later, during morning round, I saw them again and asked the mom, if everything is okay, do you have any questions? She looked at me and she said, I don't know, nobody explained anything up till now. And I was in shock. I was thinking in my head, well, what does she mean nobody explained? It was me! I explained everything 2 days ago. And then I realized that she was right. I didn't explain it properly. I didn't create the connection. I'm sure each one of you was at least one time in the physician office. And it's always the same. We enter to the doctor, we explain about our symptoms, explain what kind of medication we need to take in a perfect monologue. And then when he asks if we have any questions, we get into this mental freeze, we just nod with our head and go out. And 5 minutes after we go out from the clinic, we remember we forgot to ask so many questions about side effects, and actually 50% of what he said we forgot. So we as physicians need to explain things properly. We need to create a connection and to give our full attention. So we decided to change things in our department, to have a new approach. For example, we don't speak with the parents in the incubator or while handling the baby. We take them to a quiet room. We listen to the concerns. we give them our full attention, and at the end, we added the question, what did you understand from all that? We also wanted to continue the contact even when they are not in the department. So we text them an SMS update. Every morning at 9 o'clock, they get an SMS regarding their child. For example, your child is in room 6, his last weight is 1.7 pounds, he finished all the battles and we need more breast milk. And the results were amazing. Parents felt much more reassured, more confident. They felt that we are available. They had less anxiety and stress. And actually, they felt that we care. We created contact and connection, and they felt our compassion. We have the Levine family. They come every year to celebrate Daniel's birthday with us. Daniel was a 24-week preterm, extremely small, had many, many complications. The parents spent months in our department. And every year they come, Mr. Levine tells me, you know, Dr. Strauss, I want to tell you, from the whole time we were here, the main thing I remember is the day Daniel was born. I remember you and the team rushing out of the delivery room. That was the incubator. I joined you towards the department. And suddenly you stopped, you looked at me with a smile, and you told me, congratulations. And at that moment, I understood that I am father. For better or worse, I am father, and it gave me hope. So words created connection. Unfortunately, not all our preterms survive. And sometimes, during the last day or moment, parents tend to disconnect. We had one situation where a baby, after extremely difficult delivery, did not survive and died after 4 days. I remember the parents, Sharon and her husband, were not in the department in the last day, and I went outside to talk to them. And I asked Sharon, please, why don't you come and say goodbye to your child? She said, I cannot, it's too painful. And I told her, I know it's the most difficult situation I'm asking you to be in, but it's extremely important that you can't say goodbye to him. And in the end, she did. And she came, and we let her hold her baby, and she sat there for a few moments, saying goodbye to him. 2 years later, I got a call from the maternity ward. Someone wanted to see me. So I came there, and suddenly I saw Sharon. And she just had a new baby. And it was very emotional for both of us, and she hugged me, and she said, I want to thank you all for insisting that I will say goodbye to my child 2 years ago, because only like that, I could close that door and continue on with my life. And now I have a perfect, healthy child. Touch can heal. And we create contact. And it's from a mother to a child, from a physician to a patient, from one person to another. Our department is like a microcosmos of the universe. We encounter great joy for bringing new life. We encounter grief and sorrow from occasional death. We have sadness and happiness, pain and joy combined together. And I know every day that I will have to confront these mixed feelings. And I cannot do that without compassion. In our overwhelmed, hectic world, where technology replaced everything, it replaced even essentials such as oxygen, food, and water. It cannot and will not replace compassion. And we need compassion in this world. Aren't they beautiful, these children? We all feel compassion for babies. We all want to hug and kiss them. But somewhere along our life course, we forget this feeling. And we need to go back to this feeling of compassion for children. We need to go back to our basics. We need to go back to the contact, connection, and compassion. And we need to start with contact. And don't misunderstand me, I'm not saying you have to touch every person that you see in the subway. Contact means a tap on your shoulder, friend, a high five to your colleague, looking up from our computer and laptop and cell phone, and creating eye contact and smile. So we create contact and connection, it will inevitably, we will have compassion. So we can start today, right here, right now. Ask yourself every day, did I have any connection with others? Was I present? Did I give my full attention to my mom, my friend, my child? Because remember, your touch and smile can create all the difference to them. Thank you.
Okay, so now I'm just going to show you about 2.5 minutes of something else, okay? Just to follow that up.
No.
All right, so that's AMA, A-M-M-A, that most of you know very well. I have to give you your suggested homework for today, for this week, in fact. So here is suggested homework for this week, and I hope that you talk to somebody else about what you experience in class, what you're learning, and also about what you're doing, what ways you're trying to open these areas. If you just keep it to yourself, it doesn't, it's not potentiated. Okay, so four possibilities for homework. First possibility, answer the question, where do I find flow? Where might I find flow? Some people have a lot of flow in their life. They get lost in projects, in people, very easily. They forget about themselves. They just merge with what they're doing. Other people have lost that ability completely. And flow is something that they had in childhood. You know, they're playing and they forgot to come in for dinner, but they don't have it anymore. So the question is, where do you find flow in your life at present? And if not, where could you find flow in your life? Where possibly could you lose yourself, get lost in something? That's a huge question. Second, pay attention to touching and being touched. Whether it's your cat, or a rock, or a person that you hug, whatever it is, pay attention to touching and being touched. Just a little bit goes a very long way. There's all this great psychological research about when waitresses touch the person that they're giving the tip to, the bill to, they get way larger tips. Just like this, they like this. Just a tiniest touch changes the attitude of the person. Touch is really important.
Even touching yourself.
Okay, even touching yourself, because it stimulates oxytocin. Yeah. Okay, third, how emotionally intelligent are you? How aware are you moment to moment of how you feel? Without judging it, without trying to change it, it's your organismic response to your life at this point. How aware of you are you of your feelings? How well are you dealing with them? How well are you aware of other people's feelings? And how well are you dealing with them? And fourth, make a connection that you have been putting off or are hesitating about making. Make a connection that otherwise you might not make on any level. Yeah. Whether it's petting the dog next door or calling somebody up that you've been thinking about. Whatever it is, make a connection. It's a good habit. All right. I will see you and your artwork next week. Get here early.
Thank you.
Welcome.